Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's podcast is brought to you by 8 Sleep. If you're looking for a good night's sleep, particularly with the hot weather, just stick around for a little while. Joining me on the podcast today is Adam White. By the way, Adam, welcome back. Appreciate it very much.
It's good to be back, Charlie.
Adam directs the C. Boyden Gray Center for the Study of the Administrative State at George Mason University Scalia Law School. I'd love to see your business card, by the way. And this is significant. On Wednesday, Adam will be joining the American Enterprise Institute as a resident scholar. So congratulations.
Oh, thanks, Charlie. I enjoyed my time at Hoover. It's a wonderful place, but I'm excited to join AEI and get started in their new program on conservatism, the courts, and the Constitution.
Okay, so resident scholar, do you like have to live there? There's like a dormitory, there's a bunk.
Oh, definitely. I've already put up rock and roll posters on the walls. It's going to be great.
I mean, you know, you might show up on the first day of resident scholarship and, you know, you have to bunk with Jonah Goldberg and his dogs or something like that.
Well, as long as he brings the cigars, we'll have a good time.
Okay, so what should we talk about today other than what's been going on? I told Peter Weiner this yesterday. The gun issue is one of those issues that frustrates me no end because I just feel we're in this huge loop where the same arguments are made over and over and over again. But you made an interesting point that got me thinking about all of this. And I was on one of the MSNBC shows, and they were focusing on Mitch McConnell and what's going to happen in Congress. And of course, you know, spoiler alert, absolutely nothing's going to happen in Congress. But, you know, you made the point, though, that this is one of those issues in which it's worth remembering that we are a federalist system, and that simply because Congress won't do anything does not mean that we can't politically act in any way, at least at the state level.
Well, that's right, Charlie. And before I start, I just want to say I listened to your conversation with our friend Peter. And as always, it was a must listen. I agree with everything he said. And I think both you and him really keyed in on the key point that everything we're debating right now on this issue and the controversy surrounding the policy response, if any, it really reflects a deeper sort of brokenness in our society. I sometimes say this hole in America's soul that our politics is filling in really terrible ways. And so I agree with all of that everything we're talking about today is riding on top of these much deeper sort of problems and brokenness in our politics and our society. But when we turn to the policy response, I've been struck just in the immediate days after these horrific attacks, I've been struck by the focus on Congress. And what I haven't seen so much in terms of a debate around state-level policy reforms. Because it's true, the Second Amendment protects our right to keep and bear arms, and that's a crucial protection in our Constitution. And it's true that the Supreme Court reaffirmed that in Heller and in the McDonald versus Chicago case. But that right and the description of that right in the Supreme Court's decisions, it leaves a lot of room for policy experiment. And I think this seems a crucial time for us to turn to federalism and allow the states to be, as Justice Brandeis famously called them, laboratories of democracy, and allow and create space for the states and localities to try to experiment with regulation surrounding some of these weapons, you know, questions about licensing and so on. The states obviously have always done that, and sometimes they've done, I think, too much. The D.C. being a famous case about states going overboard or a city going overboard. But this, with all the debate over what can and can't be done and the practical limitations of a policy response, we really ought to, especially as conservatives, instinctively turn towards federalism as the place where we can have some experiments over what kind of legislation or policy response is actually feasible and what the trade-offs are.
Yeah, and of course, we do have a track record there. Florida, which would be a notoriously gun-friendly state, did react after the Parkland shooting. And, you know, and of course, there's a range of laws. So let's go back to the point you made before. You do have the Supreme Court in the Heller and the McDonald cases affirming that the Second Amendment is, in fact, an individual right, which is a controversial position. But still, there's wide latitude for regulation. So give me some sense of like how wide is that latitude under existing governing Supreme Court decisions?
Well, as I have the quote right in front of me, just let me read four lines. Scalia, after laying out what you just said, that the Second Amendment does protect an individual right, not inherently connected to militia service, he says, nothing in our opinion should be taken to cast doubt on longstanding prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill, or laws forbidding the carrying of firearms in sensitive places such as schools or government buildings, or laws imposing conditions and qualifications on the commercial sale of arms. And then he goes on to say another important limitation is that it's limited to the sorts of weapons that were protected. The sorts of weapons protected were those in common use at the time of the amendment. And of course, that doesn't mean we're limited to just muskets and so on. But what they say is there is a historic tradition of prohibiting the carrying of, quote, dangerous and unusual weapons. Not just unusual weapons, but dangerous weapons. Of course, all weapons are dangerous. But the point of all of this is that there's plenty of room for play in the joints. And we've seen, I think, as always, a fascinating debate, even just within the right now, over the practicalities of these of restrictions on guns. Charles Cook at National Review has a very strong and thoughtful piece up yesterday criticizing the New York Post, which was calling for gun control. He says a lot of these things just aren't feasible. You can't regulate these things just based on muzzle velocity or the rate of fire and so on. I mean, those are – I agree with on muzzle velocity. I'm not so sure about rate of fire, but in any event – this is precisely why we have federalism. Let states do their best, responding to local circumstances, to try to regulate some things, and let's see what happens. Especially when you know a state like Texas and a state like New York are just vastly different in their culture and in the use of weapons for hunting purposes and other things. This is the place where conservatives really need to default back to federalism.
Well, this goes back to this question of feasibility, and I talked about this with Peter yesterday. I mean, on two levels. You know, number one, do the regulations, you know, actually reduce crime? Would any of these proposed laws have prevented any of the massacres? And of course, that's part of the debate that occurs, that, you know, which law would have stopped Newtown? Which law would have prevented what happened in El Paso or in Dayton? And there's not an easy answer to all of those. And then, of course, there's the feasibility of, like, well, what do you do in a country that is, awash in guns? I mean, the guns are out there. Short of gun confiscation, which is not going to happen, what are we going to do? On the other hand, and I'm, by the way, very open to these ideas of, I mean, to the critique saying that none of these specific proposals would, in fact, have prevented these massacres. However, you mentioned states being laboratories of democracy. Well, you look on a more global scale, you have various national policies, which are also laboratories. And the reality is that America does stand out. We are exceptional in this negative way. In Great Britain, they do not have these massacres. Outside of this country, these incidents do not occur. And policies, in fact, that are in place obviously have affected this. So the rest of the world does look at the United States and goes, "What is with you? Your policies are extreme. They're wacky. Or as one commentator said this morning, they are bonkers, and you are living through the consequences of all of that." So we do know that there are governmental policies that have effectively. Well, maybe it's not just the governmental policies and cultures that, in fact, do not have the kind of mass murders that we're experiencing right now in this country.
Yeah, we're just fundamentally different from these other countries in so many ways. Many ways, you know, that make America the greatest country in the world, and maybe in the history of the world. Also, you know, the downside of this is the spiritedness and the independence that gives rise to the greatness of America. Also, the cost of this is in things like violent crime and so on. It's impossible to sort of point at just the gun laws and say that's what makes America different. We're just different in so many ways.
Let me just focus on this.
Yeah, sure.
We are different in many ways, but this does seem to be the number one variable. The access to high-powered, rapid-firing weapons with large magazines, and this does seem to be relevant to what we're experiencing right now. I mean, we are not the only country that has mental illness. We're not the only country that has the internet. We're not the only country that has disaffected young men. But we are the only country that seems to be caught up in this weird cycle. And look, I'm resisting going here. But How do you not go to the prevalence of guns?
Well, I'm not going to disagree with any of what you just said. I agree with all of that, and that's why I'm open-minded on gun regulation. All I mean is that the spiritedness of America, the independence of Americans, and just the culture, you know, ranging from the Scots-Irish tradition, America, all these other things, it just makes America a unique and spirited country in many ways, including some many terrible ways. It makes us a more violent country, and the ready accessibility, ready availability, and distribution of these weapons of mass killing really makes it even worse. And so yeah. I do agree with that. On the federalism point, I just want to say, I think your state is the perfect case study in why we need to look at this at a local level. I was just back in Wisconsin recently visiting family. I spent time both in Milwaukee, where, as you know, there's horrific crime problems. And I also spent a lot of time up in the North Woods, where hunting is a way of life. And it's impossible to have a one-size-fits-all policy for this country that's going to regulate guns and make the sorts of trade-offs between protecting us from crime while at the same time respecting our independence and respecting a lot of the cultural traditions of this country that vary so immensely across the country. I think as a practical matter, we really do need to go back to the states on this. But that requires an open-mindedness of conservatives to not just have the knee-jerk reaction, which I've always found so dissatisfying, where they say, point to how your policy response would have prevented this particular shooting, or show us how this particular weapon is the one and only one that needed to be banned, when in fact the regulations are just one part of a much greater web of societal norms that I think all work together.
And, you know, I think part of the problem has been that Republicans have outsourced their thinking on this to the NRA for some time. And I've told this story before, you know, since you mentioned Wisconsin, we had a long debate over whether or not we would allow concealed carry. And I think we were one of the very last states in the country that allowed law-abiding citizens with a permit to carry concealed weapons. Maybe we were the 48th or 49th state. I'm not sure. And so for years and years and years, we argued about all of this. And then finally, when Republicans got control of government, it was very clear that this was going to happen at some point. And then the NRA weighed in and said, no, we don't want permits. We don't want required training. We want what they called constitutional carry, which is that anyone be able to carry handguns in a concealed way. And I remember the response of local law enforcement here in Milwaukee, which was confronting this epidemic of violence. And they were horrified by the idea that you would have, quote unquote, constitutional carry, that anyone without a permit or training would be able to carry that handgun. And yet the NRA just hammered on this issue. And I felt it was, and I was a talk show host at the time, and I thought this was bait and switch. I thought, look, I've been arguing for 10 years that law-abiding citizens who pass a background check and who actually can show that they know how to use a weapon ought to be able to exercise that Second Amendment right. I thought that was a common sense position. And the NRA just hammered me and hammered me and hammered me until finally I basically said, BS. You know, I think we need to call them out on this. And I was struck by a couple things. Once you push back on them, they caved. Once Governor Scott Walker basically said, yeah, we're not going to go there, they caved. But also when I opened up the phone lines, I found that gun owners have a much more common sense approach to this than you would think listening to the leaders of the NRA. Nobody who hunts deer thinks you need a magazine with 100 bullets. No deer, would be dead today. Would be alive today if we had restrictions on some of these weapons. You don't need a bump stock to go and hunt deer. And yet there is this absolutist approach on all of these issues. Okay, I want to switch to a different question about this, because there's some really complicated legal questions, including the proposals for red flag laws. And the president suggests he might be open to that. We'll see. David French has been very, very vocal that these laws would in fact be effective and would be constitutional. But they seem to raise all kinds of questions. Like, how do you I mean, are you familiar with how they operate in any states? I'm more familiar with the theoretical than the practical implications. But the red flag law basically, if I have this correct, says that if law enforcement believes that somebody is behaving in some erratic way, you know, acting out, engaging in threats or whatever, that they can use that to intervene to take away the guns. Civil libertarian absolutists would say, but yes, you're depriving somebody of their constitutional right without due process. What is your take on those laws?
You know, I don't have a real nuts and bolts knowledge of how it's actually been practiced in states like California and Oregon. I just want to illustrate the trade-off, though. On the one hand, a red flag law, since it isn't a licensing requirement, it means it sort of protects liberty in that people have greater access to guns at the outset. Right, you don't need to get a government license to get the gun, or at least, you know, if the red flag law is a substitute for licensing. But what it does do then, as you illustrated, is it effectively delegates a police power to not just police officers, but also family members, doctors, and others who can trigger this process that can result in people being deprived of their liberty to have a particular firearm. I guess I'm wary of these things just because. I'm very wary about seeing this kind of power delegated down to private individuals in this way. But again, I think this is a place where we ought to just see how this works in some of the states that are using it. Yeah. I need to study it myself.
Because this does seem to be a common sense approach, and it does seem to answer the question, would this have prevented something that if you're a doctor, you're an educator, or you're a family member, and you see somebody behaving in a dangerous, erratic way, or you begin to think, you know, this might happen, then, you know, see something, you tell somebody, and then some action is taken. And I understand how this sounds, that it's obviously this can be abused, but also given the circumstances and the moment we are in, this does seem to be a tool that might prevent some of these random cases. All right, so the other question,
Charlie, can I just add one more thing on that?
Yeah.
Imagine what happens the day after a red flag law goes into effect or a national red flag law. There will be immense political pressure placed on the medical profession and on other professions to systematically focus on this issue in good ways and in bad ways. The amount of lobbying pressure on things like the AMA and other, the American Medical Association, and other organizations to really lean in favor of triggering red flags, it'll be enormous. I think the follow-up will be very, very interesting on these things.
So the other major question is whether or not we need to align our terrorism laws to account for what we're experiencing now. We have tremendous resources devoted to fighting foreign terrorism, but are somewhat more ambiguous when it comes to domestic terrorism. I want to read you the lead from Greg Miller's piece in the Washington Post. The United States continues to employ a staggering arsenal of armed forces, unmanned drones, intelligence agencies, and sweeping domestic authorities to contain a threat, Islamist terrorism, that has claimed about 100 lives on American soil since the nation mobilized after September 11th. No remotely comparable array of national power has been directed against the threat now emerging from the far right, a loose but lethal collection of ideologies whose adherents have killed roughly the same number of people in the United States post 9/11 as Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State combined. And the disparity is a source of growing alarm for officials and experts, some of whom now say the United States is overdue for a realignment of national security priorities as violence on the far right escalates. So I heard a commentator yesterday saying, well, you know, the FBI is focused on international terrorism, but there is no domestic terrorism law. Do we need one?
I think the analogy of this to radical Islamic terrorism is very challenging because that whole approach began, of course, with threats from overseas. Translating it into policy here at home gets very tricky, as my colleague at Hoover, Ayan Hirsi Ali, and others pointed out. The radicalization problem is real, but our, again, our culture of liberty, especially with the First Amendment and so on, really complicates what we can do at home to proactively go after people on the basis of their ideas. Now, I do think it's right to analogize the radicalization of white nationalist terrorism here at home to the radicalization of radical Islamic terrorism here at home. But what that actually means as a policy outcome, it's not clear to me. It's not clear how we could pass a sweeping federal law that goes after people first and foremost on the basis of their ideas. I will say, not to bring things back momentarily to where we started, this is one of those places where the breakdown of our culture and our society has real policy ramifications, because it used to be that these are the sorts of issues, these cultural issues, that would be dealt with at least in large part culturally through through families, through communities, and so on. And as we become more atomized, and all these smaller networks have broken down, and we turn more and more to not just government but national government to make these policies, it's doing something that our national government just may not be well equipped to do.
Well, it's obviously not well equipped to do, and there are obviously a lot of problems that government at any level is not going to be able to solve. Okay, well, now I want to get into what the trickiest aspect of all of this that we are facing right now. And let's do this in just a moment. But first, I want to hear a word from our sponsor. Today's podcast is brought to you by the Ultimate Sleep Machine. Look at the world's top tech leaders and high-growth startup CEOs, and I bet you wonder, how in the world they have that kind of inexhaustible energy to do what they do? And the answer might surprise you. The latest trend with top tech leaders is sleep optimization. While most Americans aren't getting the sleep they need, tech founders and CEOs are optimizing their sleep to perform at peak levels every day. The first step, the Pod by 8 Sleep, the ultimate sleep machine. The Pod is the first and only high-tech bed designed to help you achieve peak mind and body performance. So are you looking to sleep deeper? The Pod dynamically adjusts the temperature on each side of the bed so you're comfortable all night. Do you want to know your sleep intel? The Pod tracks your biometrics while you sleep with no need for wearable technology. Do you want to sleep better? Enjoy personalized programs and coaching designed by experts guiding you towards true sleep fitness. Because the better you sleep, the better you everything. Try the Pod for 100 nights, and if you don't love it, we'll refund your purchase and arrange for a free pickup. Only at 8sleep.com/bulwark. Now, they already sold out their first two batches, so they're going fast. For limited time, get $150 off your purchases. That's $150 off your purchase when you go to 8sleep.com/bulwark. That's EIGHTsleep.com/bulwark. All right, we're back with Adam White. I do need a good night's sleep. I have to tell you this. All right, so the other problem with dealing with domestic terrorism, and, you know, I am really once again torn between saying we need to do something about this. These acts are clearly terrorist. If for no other reason than the body count. On the other hand, I also understand how this can be abused. There's no question about it that we've seen the definitions of hate and hate speech and hate crime be abused by ideologues. But then we get to this tricky aspect, Adam, which is, you know, this particular moment we are in with this particular president. I'm going to go back to Greg Miller's piece in the Washington Post. The Trump administration has curtailed or disbanded a Department of Homeland Security program that had been created to counter violent extremism by working with regional authorities and organizations to identify those vulnerable to radicalization, whether by Islamic groups or the far right. And here's the nut paragraph. The main obstacle to mobilizing against the white supremacist threat, officials say, may be political. Trump on Monday denounced the alleged white nationalist sentiments of the suspected killer in El Paso, but his presidency has come to be defined by policies that are aligned with aspects of the white nationalist agenda and his penchant for fanning racial animus. And I guess that this is where it's hard to break out. Why is this happening right now? No one is responsible for the killing except the killers themselves. And yet we are in this moment where it is like we've opened this, you know, we've opened this, you know, door to hell of white nationalists, white supremacists who seem to feel emboldened by the current political moment.
Yeah. You know, let's not forget that this issue about white nationalism domestic terrorism and the policy response. It's not new. I was actually, of all places, I was sitting in the West Wing in 1999 when the Columbine shooting happened. I was a young intern in the White House at the time, and I was there when President Clinton crafted his speech to the nation that night. And I remember, I mean, I remember a lot about that day, but I also remember the challenge of President Clinton making a response, a rhetorical and political response that wasn't that wouldn't be taken as an attack on, say, Rush Limbaugh. You remember, throughout the 90s, there was always a concern that when you talked about domestic terrorism, it was really a Democratic administration's efforts to undermine sort of things like, or blame things like conservative talk radio and so on. Now, today, 20 years later, we're still grappling with these issues, but on a much greater scale, where these shootings are happening over and over again. And like you said, now we have a president whose election turned, at least in a small part, on cultivating this part of American society, leveraging it, exploiting it. And so the president simply doesn't have any credibility on these issues. I heard people say that, or maybe you guys said it last night in your podcast yesterday with Pete Wehner, that President Trump gave a speech yesterday that any president could have given, Clinton, Obama, Bush. But the fact is, this president, these words in his mouth just don't have the same
resonance.
No, and they
don't. He doesn't have the moral authority. And, you know, I wrote a piece today for The Bulwark where it talked about he said all the right words, you know, denounced bigotry, denounces hate, denounces white supremacy. But in his mind, what do they mean? Do they actually have any consequence? He's not willing to acknowledge that his rhetoric has contributed to this. And I understand that he doesn't think he's responsible for what happened in El Paso. And again, we always need to separate out rhetoric from actual acts of violence. But you would hope that there would be some introspection to say, okay, I have made a central part of my presidency the demonization of minorities. I have described immigration as an invasion, immigrants as invaders. I've used words like infestation. I have provided oxygen to people who have toyed at the edges of white nationalism. I have emboldened them. Many of the themes that were in that manifesto sound like they were from one of my rallies. But it would be actually a rather dramatic moment if the president would say, okay, you know what? I still think that we need to secure the border, but I understand the importance of words and of rhetoric and of the messages we send. And I think every American needs to look in the mirror and ask whether or not they are contributing to the solution or to the problem. But of course, this president is just not capable of doing that. So he said the words, but the words have no consequence. I mean, it's really easy to stand up and say, I denounce hatred and white supremacy, but you know that many of the people who are doing that will never actually identify anything in the real world that they would describe as bigotry or white supremacy, at least coming from this administration, if you follow what I'm going there.
No, I do. I mean, President Trump's delivery yesterday was pretty pathetic. At the end, as he went through sort of the mantra of God blesses, I was struck by how quickly at the end he said, God bless America, and he sort of hurried off the stage as though he were double parked outside or something. I think it just wasn't a great showing. I also think, though, it's not just President Trump. I think there's a lot of us on the right, myself included, who had to do a lot of rethinking over the last few years about how, on the one hand, we call for a culture of life, we call ourselves pro-life, but the way we've conducted our politics and the way we've construed things like immigrant communities have been profoundly dehumanizing. And again, get back to where I started on the brokenness of our culture. I think until all of us, all Americans, but especially conservatives who profess, you know, allegiance to pro-life issues and culture of life, we need to really take that to heart and be pro-life in every respect. And I think it begins by not dehumanizing immigrants, not dehumanizing criminals. I think only once we get down to these deeper cultural issues of the value and sacredness of human life will we ever begin to take seriously the issue of gun crime and how to really prevent it and how to cultivate a society where this ceases to be a problem, not because of just a policy response, but because our culture and our values have helped remedy the sickness in our culture
that's
today.
Well put, and this is something that conservatives, I think, used to understand at a very visceral level, that these ideas had consequences, that the words had consequences. And it has been the demonization of political opponents and the dehumanization of others that I think has festered. And you know, weirdly and I think dangerously, there have been people who've confused that with boldness, with aggressiveness, with truth telling, that you begin using words like, you know, describing people that you don't like or, you know, as infesting a community, implying that they are somehow vermin. All of that does, you know, and, you know, as somebody who opposed Barack Obama for 8 years aggressively and vigorously on, you know, virtually on a daily basis, it's odd for me to quote him now, but his lengthy statement where he talks about the dehumanization of others and historically what it has led to was one of those cringe moments that, you know, where you play around with these concepts in order to get short-term political advantage or to gin up your base or to, you know, game the electoral college, you know, short-term. But the long-term consequences of dehumanizing people is often violence, is the kind of real crisis of division that we have in this country that I would like to say that this is going to be a turning point, but I don't think it will be.
I'm glad you mentioned President Obama. I mean, I was against so much of what he did for 8 years, and I think we shouldn't lose sight of what was wrong with his administration. But I thought his statement yesterday was eloquent. I think it's interesting to think back over the last just few years how conservatives, how offended we were when President Obama referred to people in the heartland as bitter clingers, or he said, you know, they cling bitterly to their religion and their guns or whatever. Or when Hillary Clinton talked about deplorables, that was dehumanizing in a way, but not a tenth of as dehumanizing as some of the things that our elected leaders say about other human beings today. And I think this requires some real soul searching. And I think it's a reminder that you can't just separate out what the president says and tweets and what the president's policies are, because the policies are themselves the embodiment of values, but also the president's, any president's ability to actually carry out a policy turns so much on the amount of trust that the American
people
are willing to put in a president.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because there was so much cognitive dissonance between teleprompter Trump and I think it was David Drucker's term, Twitter and rally Trump. And unfortunately, we know that Twitter and rally Trump is the real Trump, which is why I think that it seems so strained yesterday. When he went through, you know, the incantation of the words that had been written for him, but it doesn't actually change anything. You know, I think it was Arthur Brooks who makes the point that, you know, we can debate issues, you know, Americans can debate issues, you know, very vigorously without tearing the social fabric. But that moment when one or the other expresses contempt, that's when the dialogue stops, that you and I can debate taxes and everything, but the moment that one of us rolls our eyes or expresses contempt, that's the end of the dialogue. Well, you know, American political dialogue is increasingly about the expression of contempt. And so what you were describing with Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, those were, I would say, almost mildly, because we have to keep changing our standards here, but they were mildly contemptuous. And I think people reacted to this sense that you're looking down on me, you despise me, you disdain my lifestyle and my values, and therefore I reject you. And I think that's the spiral that we're in. And then, of course, you have the president who is really turning his political opponents into enemies. I mean, you know, it was just 2 weeks ago that we're talking about, you know, send her back, you know, go back where you came from, or this rhetoric that if you disagree with the administration, then you hate America, you don't love America, you are a traitor. I mean, it's one thing for me to say you are wrong in your position about the progressive income tax. It's something else to say you hate America, you hate me, you hate God, and you're a traitor.
That's right. I go back to this over and over again in the last few years, these questions of what we used to call Republican virtue. Right? The framers understood that they gave us a constitution of structure, and that structure is crucial and important, but it only works, it, as Madison says in Federalist 55, it presupposes certain virtues among the public. And I just brought this up on my screen. The closing words of Federalist 55, which I think about more and more in recent years, he says, Republican government presupposes the existence of these qualities in a higher degree than any other form of government. And then he says at the end, if there is not sufficient virtue among men for self-government, nothing less than the chains of despotism can restrain them, the people, from destroying and devouring one another. And when you look at moments like this, just the public arguments surrounding the aftermath of these shootings, it's hard not to look at Madison's warning and fear that we are very, very close to the nightmares
that he warned us against. Went back and I was reading the Federalist Papers, and I had two reactions. Number one, how prescient – three reactions. Number one, how prescient they were. Number two, how incredibly important they are to read now in this particular political moment. And then number three, how thoroughly depressing it was to read them because of exactly what you are describing. Because if you take out that factor of these Republican virtues, nothing else works. And nothing else works.
That's right. That's right. I think the task of the last 40 years, especially on the right and among constitutionalists on the right, was to reaffirm the importance of structure, separation of powers, and federalism. And that all has been a great success. I think the task for the next years, decades to come, among conservative constitutionalists is to look at this other part of the Federalist, these issues of virtue, of self-restraint, all of these things that were necessary prerequisites for our form of government. And it's time to go back to repairing those things.
The great victory of the Trump era, the Trump administration, has been the federal judiciary and the reshaping of the federal judiciary. And so I guess the question is, are we getting a Trumpian judiciary? Are we getting a judiciary that understands the values that you just were describing?
Well, I agree with you that the picks for the judiciary have been great. A conservative like me who opposed Trump, who was a never-Trumper, I have to agree that the judicial picks have been superb, really, and just in general, but also the best of the best in these picks. People like Andrew Oldham in Texas, Naomi Rao here in D.C. These are great judges who understand both the law and the principles and values that undergird the law. So I'm very, very optimistic. When John Roberts, Chief Justice John Roberts, pushed back at President Trump a few months ago, Trump was complaining about Obama judges, and Chief Justice Roberts says there are no Obama judges, there are no Republican judges, Democratic judges, they're just judges. I think who Roberts may have been protecting most of all are Trump judges, because when President Trump leaves office, his dozens and dozens and dozens of judicial appointments are going to remain on the bench, and their credibility is going to be based, at least in some small part, on the credibility of the president that appointed them. And I think the real challenge for those judges going forward is to really embody the best values of the federal judiciary so that no one can ever accuse them of being Trump judges. They'll just be judges in the best sense.
Well, that's one of the advantages of having the lifetime tenure, because then you have a different perspective on life. Adam White, thank you so much for joining me again on the Bulwark Podcast, and congratulations on your new gig at AEI. And thank
Thanks,
you
Charlie.
For listening to the Bulwark Podcast. Today's podcast was brought to you by 8sleep.com, and you can get a great deal at 8sleep.com/bulwark. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will be doing this all over again.